Rusty Quill presents.
Hey folks, Josh here. No PA announcements this week, sad trombone noises, but we do have some exciting news. What's in the Rift will be taping its first live recording ever this fall. And because we don't know how to do anything small, we'll be doing it at the world's biggest gathering of tabletop and board game players in North America. This August, you can come see me and the rest of the cast of What's in the Rift live at Gen Con. Tickets are $6. You'll need a badge in order to buy those tickets, but I imagine at least some of you will already be there anyhow. Be sure to get your tickets and badges fast, though, as things tend to sell out pretty quickly. All right, that's it. We'll have more updates on that once we have more details, closer to the event booklet becoming available in May. In the meantime, please enjoy What's in the Rift. Be advised that this episode of What's in the Rift contains death by fire, mentions of death by disease, and a child in peril. For the best listening experience, we recommend headphones.
Previously on What's in the Rift.
There is a dead cop on the side of the road. And the retracting Koyos machines. And a woman sitting in your lap, Jenny, who has just informed you that things are about to get interesting.
Jenny, I think I fucked something up.
Whatever it is, it's not good. Those things are there specifically to monitor for activities against the state or UCRI. It's not going to end well for any of us. So find a way to get this thing moving. We have to get out of here, or I'm going to be jumping over the guardrail there and taking my chances with the drop to the ground.
Looking up from underneath the hood at the front of the car, Bruce, you notice that every car that you can see on the 408 right now is slowing to a halt.
Jackie, do you see this?
Vicky, what's happening?
Whatever it is, it's not good. Those things are there specifically to monitor for activities against the state or UCRI. It's not going to end well for any of us.
However, there is still the problem of the inhibitor on your engine.
I'm just going to shock it with the baton.
Let's try the shocking and then maybe a couple of...
Yeah, worked on that, dude.
You short it out and make it stop working in whatever form that takes.
Oh, God.
Okay.
How many plot points would it take to make this work?
Yeah, like I have plot points. I will pay them.
How many are you willing to spend?
I will spend 2 to make this work.
So you drop this baton and you press it to this device and you give it a relatively gentle squeeze, at least in comparison to the absolute wrenching squeeze that you gave it before jabbing it into that cop. There's a sound that accompanies it. It's a hiss, an arcing sound almost, but there's also a thunk, almost like something is retracting violently back into a housing. You get in the car, Jenny, you press the button, nothing happens. You remember that you have to blow into this fucking interlock device again. You blow into it, you press the button, and the engine springs to life.
Hell yeah.
However, that same hissing arc that you had thought was coming from your baton hasn't stopped, even though the device underneath the hood had clunked back into place. And there is a building tone on the air of electricity arcing.
Josh, I gave you plot points.
Fucking floor it! Go, now! Yes, yes, you've got this! You're going to make it!
I don't got it.
And that's when...
What's in the Rift is intended for mature audiences. This show includes death, drug use, criminal activity, and a consistent undercurrent of existential dread. Any children discovered listening to this show will get the hammer.
Second, where you feel, holy shit, we might get out of this. It didn't hit anything. But in that same breath, that last little bit, that last fleeting moment of hope, you start to feel disconnected. The air around you smells like ozone and bitter. If a smell could be bitter, this air smells bitter. You look down, you look at your hands, and it's hard for you to even accept these as being yours. They just look like some platonic ideal of a hand. While each of you has your own independent thoughts leading up to this, the one common thread is that you don't feel like yourselves, like anything at all. You don't feel like you are in a moment of continuous existence from the second before to the second after, like you have stopped being yourself. And that is the last thought that you have before you slip into a state of unconsciousness. Except for you, Tosca. Tosca, you watch everyone around you slowly stare into the middle distance. Victoria, who is perched in Jenny's lap, starts to slump over the wheel, and thankfully it appears Jenny's foot has gone slack on the accelerator because the car coasts to a gentle stop and starts idling along at no more than a couple miles an hour before you reach a small rise in the roadway and it stops completely.
So everybody's on ketamine then, is what's happening?
Well... Very similar.
Okay, so the whole van's in a K-hole. Gotcha.
First, I should have figured that you'd be able to identify the drug equivalent of this.
Right.
But this is actually, I mean, you've identified what it is. This is drugs of some sort. But the means of delivery, or what specifically the drug is not known to you. Judging by the fact that everyone else has slipped into a state of unconsciousness while you are still very much alert should be the clearest indicator of that.
My first immediate goal is going to be trying to figure out how I can get Jenny and Victoria out of the driver's seat and either into the back or into the passenger seat.
Okay. Tell me how you want to do that, because the next thing that you notice is the distant sound of a rotor wash.
Okay, and so if I remember correctly, it is Jenny sitting under Victoria in the front driver's seat. I'm ducked down on the passenger floorboard, and everybody else is in the back. Okay, so first thing I'm going to do is grab Victoria and slide her off of Jenny and try to get her sat into the passenger seat. And then after that, pick up Jenny and see if I can sort of push her off into the back seat.
Okay.
Just enough space for me to get in the driver's seat.
That sounds like a two-step plan. You need to remove Victoria and you need to remove Jenny.
Right.
In a way that you're able to get yourself into the driver's seat.
Exactly.
It's going to be hard to maneuver two people independently in here. I'm going to say that you'll be able to do it, but this test is going to be about whether you can do it in time before whatever is approaching arrives.
Okay, so the thing has stopped, right? So I guess probably the best option would be to put this SUV in park, hop out of the passenger seat, run around to the driver's side, push Victoria over, then I can sort of just lift Jenny up and sort of push her in the back.
All right. So as described, that's a lot of steps. And we're talking about a vehicle that it's not like as a bus where there's a center space where you can just push her off easily into an open area next to the seat. There's a center console and other things that you'll have to navigate the stack of two people around. If it were just Jenny, you could probably lift her out and move her over to the passenger seat, get in the driver's seat and drive away yourself, right?
I would probably actually try to move Victoria before I even get out of the car. Reach toward her and pull her as far as I can into the passenger seat over the center console. Not worry about Jenny yet.
Let's deal with the roll to move Victoria and how deftly you'll do that first.
Okay.
So this will be a D6 challenge, but we are including the crisis die of the rift is crumbling for this. So that is, if I'm not mistaken, 2D8.
I'm going to use resourceful by necessity. I'm going to use my D12 for self-preservation. I'm going to use spiritualist.
Okay.
And then I'm going to go with my... Can I use my relationship with Jenny? I mean, she has passed out at the moment. So, okay, cool. We'll do that. I'm wondering if I want to use my doing it the hard way.
Let me let you know what the result of my roll was, because it will help inform your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
I rolled a 12 with one opportunity.
I've got an 8 and a 6. Ready to go. That's 14.
All right. Because this is a test that can generate an asset, choose one of your die to have an effect die. Any of the dice in your pool that was not used in your result can be chosen as an effect die.
Okay. I'm going to use the D12 then.
Okay. Now there's a D12 effect on this situation. You grab Victoria and you get your hands underneath her arms and you pull her as much as you can into your seat and across that center console. She is dead weight, but Victoria is a rather slight woman. You are able to manipulate her rather easily to get her limbs into the passenger side of the vehicle. And as you're scooting back, trying to make room for her, you reach behind, you open the door, and she just slides into the seat. Tell me what you do next, because now you gotta get Jenny out. Do you have an additional D12 in this next pool?
So I'm going to hop out of the passenger side. First, I'm going to hit the door lock to make sure all the doors are unlocked and run around the SUV, open the door where Jenny is, and see if I can maneuver her either over the center console or like push her back behind the center console to the backseat.
This is a D10 challenge because you've left the vehicle, you've moved around, you are now taking some large steps. And that's, it wouldn't have been any smaller if you'd stayed in the vehicle or that. This is just... This is the harder of the tests. I've rolled my test here.
Okay.
For this, and it was a D10 test this time with the two D8 crisis dice. And I have a 17.
Oh, shit. So I am going to roll again. Same dice pool, by the way. I have a 10 from that opportunity dice and then 9. And I have no 1, so 19.
So, no heroic successes. I'm going to describe to you how this plays out. As you back your way out of the door and Victoria settles into the seat, you close that door and you look up at the horizon to see there are two white helicopters. Helicopters very similar to the one that you saw approaching the canal just 12 hours ago that are now approaching the stretch of highway. You would judge, looking at them, that they're no more than a half a mile away at this point. Close enough that you can see them getting larger as they near. You circle the SUV, you open the door, and Jenny, being Jenny, has buckled in underneath Victoria and is slumped forward across the steering wheel now that you've moved her. Tell me what you do to get her moved.
I'm just going to slide my hand under and hit the belt buckle button. And then I'm going to grab her under her knees and sort of like lift her up and back. So like she sort of falls backward into the back seat. I love Jenny, but I'm unconcerned about her any broken bones at the moment. I'm just trying to save everybody.
You're trying to shove her over the console or over the seat?
Yeah, you know, like at an angle to the right, over her right shoulder, just sort of roll her back into the back seat.
Okay. You tilt her up and Jenny rolls backwards and is luckily narrow enough to fit rather comfortably in between these two front seats. And you push her into the back seat. Jenny flops a little bit, but lands on the floorboards at the feet of a passed out Robert and a passed out Blanche. Tosca, you are able at this point to sit down in the driver's seat and take control of this vehicle. I will remind you, you are far from an experienced driver, having your first driving experience less than 24 hours ago.
I am, but this is an automatic, correct?
It is an automatic. You look up after having tossed Jenny back, closing the door, getting yourself inside the vehicle, and you can see that roughly 400 yards over the surface of the roadway here, these helicopters are beginning to descend. Tell me what you do.
I'm going to push the gas as hard as humanly possible and try to keep it in a straight line for as long as I can.
You start tearing out, and the car bucks, and the tires screech. All at once, they gain purchase on the roadway, and you leap forward. It's startling how much power is generated in this car, but luckily for you, Jenna, up until recently, its owner, the recently deceased Jenna, as you leave a trail of bodies behind you throughout Central Florida, was into souping up her car. The power is enough that it loses control a little bit and you start to fishtail. This is going to be a relatively easy test, but this is the last test we'll need to see if you can get out of here before these helicopters have a chance to really stop you from leaving the immediate area. Can you regain control of this car, this unexpectedly powerful SUV? This is a D6 challenge with no crisis dice attached. And you have to beat an 8.
Resourceful by necessity, self-preservation. Do I still have that extra 12?
No.
This time I'm just going to use scoundrel because I'm like running from the police.
Police, but you're running from an authority for sure.
I need one more. I'm just going to stick with Jenny.
Okay.
And let's see.
Is Tosca developing an affinity for Jenny, almost like an older brother kind of situation here? Because it seems like...
Well, I mean, you know, me and Jenny have been down since the whole thing started, so...
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
I have an 8 and an 11.
Okay, well, an 8 and an 11 is a heroic success, so not only do you gain control of this thing, you are able to actually use some of the momentum generated by it. So tell me exactly how this happens. You have a helicopter at the back of this inclusion zone that is almost completely touched down, but maybe only 100 yards over you at this point, ahead of you is a helicopter descending, and you begin to rapidly accelerate towards it.
Well, I'm going to drive under it as quickly as possible, and when I am, I'm sticking my middle finger out the window pointed up so that the helicopter can see it. And then I'm just going to drive and not stop.
You peel out and you go flying underneath this helicopter, flipping at the bird. And I'm sure giving it a shout. And if the radio weren't punched out already, it almost magically would be punched on at this point.
Yeah.
And you start driving away on what is now a largely empty 408 state road, leading towards 75 North. You have no idea where you're going, though, do you, Tosca? You have no freeways to reference in your Florida.
No, but I do
know
that everything is north of Florida. So
yes. So this is going to be interesting because the effects that the rest of everyone here is under are going to last for quite some time. You accurately identified that this is ketamine-like in the way that it works. It is not exactly ketamine because ketamine does not catalyze from any substance with ozone. But this does.
But it is a disassociative.
It very much is a disassociative. You peel off underneath this helicopter. You start tearing away. You start heading in the general direction of the 75. You are heading west currently. Mm-hmm. And the helicopter behind you stops descending. And almost in like a moment of indecision, you can catch in the rearview mirror, it seems to hover at about 100 yards above the roadway before it reorients itself and starts ascending again. and moving in your direction.
Okay. So it is chasing us.
Yes. Here's how we're going to do this. We're not going to go through every detail of you driving solo with a bunch of passed out folks in the back of the car, but you do need to find a way out of Orlando. It's open road for most of the stretch up to Highway 75, and there's clear signage there. Do you recall where you were supposed to go?
Manchester.
I thought we had already pulled it up on someone's phone.
So, yeah, the GPS is already going, and it's like, fucking go straight, like that. So I'm listening to it.
A quarter mile ahead, fucking go straight.
You get to about 2 miles out from the interchange with Interstate 75, and your phone barks a command at you that you should be watching out for upcoming exits. You check your rear view, you check your side views.
Exit on the motherfucking right.
You don't see any sign of this helicopter, but if you turn on the music for long enough, you can still hear the rotor wash out the window. You come up to the exit and get onto 75, and almost immediately you can see that there is significant traffic on 75 heading north. There is a long series of trucks in the right lane that are moving at a slow rate, and it isn't, except for the leftmost lane, that there seems to be any progress. The leftmost lane, of course, adorned with diamonds indicating a high occupancy vehicle lane. Some things remain constant across all universes, and that is one of them. How it ended up in Florida, though, your guess is good as mine.
Okay. Well, this is definitely a high occupancy vehicle. Let's go.
Here's your challenge, Daska. You come up to the end of this ramp, and you have multiple lanes of traffic to navigate through, and you are not exactly an experienced driver in traffic.
I would be very nervous.
I think understandably. This is going to be a D8 challenge with crisis dice included. So tell me what Tosca is doing to get you navigated onto 75 and merged in the appropriate lane.
So I would do my damnedest to like avoid the traffic, period, and get into the shoulder lane and drive around everybody. And I don't give a shit who's looking at me crazy at
that
point.
You're going to be that person? You know,
yeah, I'm going to be that person. Yeah, I've got a truck.
He's never driven before.
People.
He don't know.
I've got to get him to safety. Exactly.
I mean, you're in Florida, so probably half the people will follow you.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's fucking exactly what happens. I pull off the ramp, I hop into the shoulder lane, and I'm just cruising along. And before too long, I look up, and behind me, there's like a whole train of cars falling along behind us saying, fuck the traffic.
I love that.
There is a narrow shoulder here, but it is largely dirt. And you start moving on this, and despite all the solid white lines, you start to see traffic cutting over behind you. You do see 2 to 3 cars think that this guy's got the right idea and start peeling behind
him. Yeah, he does.
You're kicking up a rather significant dust cloud in this process as you move over the tightly packed gravel in the shoulder area. You start accelerating and you're overtaking cars rapidly, and the cars behind you keep pace. And as you're moving along in this right lane, you see an almost identical black SUV as you pass it. Same make, same model. It looks like it could be the same vehicle. You are several miles down the road on the Florida Turnpike, and you've made good progress. You start to feel like you might be able to relax a little bit. It's been a while since you've heard the rotor wash or any other indication of the helicopter behind you. There is an exit on the right coming up if you fully want to give this helicopter the slip, but it will take you off course from your GPS, and you will not be able to use it.
So I'm going to take the exit and hope I can go back down the other side and stay in the shoulder.
You're on the shoulder of the Florida Turnpike, kicking up a sizable dust cloud into the traffic, following you, basically avoiding the slowed movement in the rightmost lanes. And now that you're coming up on road work, you're starting to understand why the slowdown has occurred.
Right.
You pull off onto the off-ramp towards a Hancock Road. There is signage there that indicates north versus south. And thankfully, the off-ramp from this exit with the yield sign and the merge avoids the stoplight and heads north. Do you take that? Is that your plan?
Yes, that is what I'm going to do.
Okay.
WTAF.
This area is largely open field and swamp. There are a number of vehicles that would look to be construction vehicles. As you continue along this road, you can see the beginnings of what appear to be a cookie cutter suburban development that is springing up. Until you come to the end of Hancock Road, you are very much in an undeveloped part of Florida here. Up ahead, there appears to be some roads that lead to some type of development that is under construction, but also obviously not with anything remotely habitable back there. You see signage denoting this road as a county road, and it heads off east or west. There is a sign approaching this crossroads that says Ferndale, and it points off to the right, or there is, you know, back towards the left, which if you are good with cardinality, you would assume would lead you back in the direction of the turnpike.
I don't want to go back toward the turnpike, so my only other option is to go away from it, right?
Right now, yes.
Yes, so that's what I'm going to do. I am not going to turn around. I'm going to keep trying to move forward.
You take a right onto County Road 561A towards Ferndale. You've set yourselves in motion to take surface streets, avoiding the major roads out of Florida. You pull to the side of the road as you get into Ferndale once you feel that it's safer and you want to venture a peek, so to speak, to see if you can see if that helicopter is anywhere in sight.
Right. The way that I would likely do that is try to find a truck stop or a gas station of some sort and like hold off for a few minutes and see if anything develops.
As you pull into Ferndale, you do find a gas station. Ferndale's a very small town, but it is a town. And there is a gas station there that you pull off into. You're getting out of the car, I'm assuming?
At this point, like, I want to make sure everybody's still alive because I haven't had a chance to give anybody any sort of attention based on their health.
You pull into this gas station. It's got slightly run-down pumps, and it would appear that at least two of them have yellow bags over them, preventing you from using the handles to fill the car, but you don't know that from Jack anyways. This is really the very first actual gas station you may have ever seen.
Right. New territory for me.
You pull in, you do a reasonable job parking, and do you turn off the engine?
No, I would not turn off the engine. Number one, to keep the AC going, probably, because it's probably hot as fuck. It's sure. Unseasonably warm, I'm sure. And,
These are facts.
And then I would just, like, I would get out of the car and go to each door and, like, check everybody's pulse.
You get out of the car, you don't hear the rotor wash anywhere as you do, and you make your way around opening doors and checking pulses. You can lean over before you even get out of the vehicle, and you can see the rise and fall of Victoria's chest.
Okay.
She is unresponsive, but she is still breathing. You give a cursory glance into the back seat, and you can tell also that Jenny is alive, if asleep. And as you get out of the vehicle and make your way around, you do a convincing job, at least not enough for anybody to immediately know that you're some interdimensional traveler checking on their knocked out friends.
Right.
reaching in and checking to make sure that Blanche and Robert and Bruce are all responsive. And you look into the very back and you see back there Jackie slumped on her side, and laid completely on his back is Ace with his head in her lap. You can see Ace still breathing.
Okay.
You can see Jackie with her head leaned forward. You also hear an audible snore.
Okay. So everybody's good.
You have every reason to believe that they are very passed out, but also still alive.
Well, Tosca's feeling fucking great right now, because that is good news. So probably at this point, if it doesn't appear that anybody's getting up anytime soon, what time of day is it?
When you left Orlando, it was about 10 in the morning. It's about 11 now.
Okay. Really, the only real option I have, as long as I don't need gas and everything is good on that front, is to reset the GPS. Try to set up options in a way that it avoids interstates and see about heading north. And then wait, because I don't want to hop back on the interstate while I'm alone, because I was nervous the first time.
You plug all this information in your GPS, it routes you north through largely rural parts of Central Florida. Some real scary small towns, it looks like.
Deliverance shit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's swamp towns in Central Florida.
Right.
And it's a long road, but you do manage to set out. You make your way all the way up through Lake City. It takes you on 441 north to Fargo. And it's at that point that you realize you've crossed over into Georgia. It's late afternoon at this point. You would say approaching 4 o'clock. It's slow going, taking surface streets out of Florida. Florida is a state that is almost all transport is predicated on highways. And the choice that you've made has made this a particularly long and slogging endeavor. However,
but safe and slow.
It is safe. It does keep you away from installations of Koyos machines, which would have propped up again on the freeway had you chosen to take it.
I'm immune to those guys.
And you've made your way out of Florida into, for the first time since you were a very young child, a place that is not what you knew as the reservation.
Now there's just a bunch of private prisons everywhere because it's South Georgia.
Oh, no.
We're going to take a moment to discuss what is happening with the rest of you while this is going on. You've all fallen into a deep slumber, but while your bodies have slipped into this inoperable state, every one of your minds is racing, and you feel as if you are experiencing your lives in reverse right now. And the one thing that is common for each of you is that you're seeing your life laid out as a chain of things that seemed like an inevitable progression to this very moment, laying unconscious in the back of a stranger's SUV, a murdered stranger's SUV. Blanche, you see working a job at a Dollar General in Pierce, Idaho, and this is one of a number of jobs you've worked in similar dollar stores in this area. Is that correct?
Yes.
What's this job like for Blanche?
Disposable.
Yet another job in a long series of jobs like this. Is it always dollar stores?
Sometimes gas stations, sometimes McDonald's.
How many do you figure you have left in this area before you're out of them?
Probably a handful.
So maybe a little less disposable than it was previously.
Right. Just have to drive farther and farther.
Before that, you'd spent time at the University of Michigan, halfway across the country. What was it you were studying for?
I was studying zoology, specifically veterinary medicine. At least, that was the ultimate goal.
That didn't quite work out, did it?
No. No, it didn't.
And that's what led you back here, home, to North Central Idaho, and a long series of dead-end jobs.
Correct.
And before that, an almost formative moment for you, standing at your back door to your family home, staring up into the sky, when your father steps forward and puts his hand on your shoulder and asks you what you're doing with the door open, Blanche.
I let my prized parrot, Johnson, go.
The same Johnson that would seemingly reappear to you, that you would swear that you've seen elsewhere for the next several years of your life?
Yes.
It's been a long string of events that's led you here, each one building off of the previous. And yet now here you are, analyzing them almost as if completely removed, as if they'd happened in some life that was not your own. Bruce. You are looking at yourself not but a couple years ago. You find yourself at BlizzCon 2019. And you've stopped, and much to your surprise, you've found yourself in a conversation now for at least 15, 20 minutes with the same woman about the blizzard.
Shocking.
It's not the same kind of rote recitation of events that happened or spouting catchphrases. You've been speaking now about what the blizzard means to you, and she's in the middle of an impassioned retelling of how the blizzard helped pull her out of a dark part of her life. Can you tell me a little bit about the woman in front of you?
Angie, that would be Angie Mancho, and she's about Bruce's age, early 40s. Got a short reddish hair. She's just a little bit taller than Bruce. She's about 5'6". And that's not what Bruce notices. He notices everything she says about the blizzard, in the same way that it has affected her life, just like it's affected his, the way that she seems to see it from a different perspective than seemingly everyone else he talks to at this convention, that it's almost like the blizzard was always a part of her, the same way it feels like it's always been a part of him.
She is reaching into her wallet now and pulling out a picture of a young boy holding a skateboard. And she's laughing and passing it to you.
Oh, you got a little athlete there.
She nods and she says the name Hans, and you smile. A few years prior to this, you're cracking open the cover of your very first Blizzard graphic novel. Can you tell me what Bruce's life is like at this point?
At this point, most of what Bruce has done has really just been chasing the corporate ladder, but not incredibly successfully, just kind of in want of anything else to do, looking for some sort of definition. He just has known that success is having a good job, and even if he doesn't necessarily want everything that comes with it or feel completely equipped or comfortable doing it, he throws himself wholeheartedly into acquiring a title. He's been a big comics fan for most of his adult life, like a lot of adults are in his world, but it's just a kind of way to pass the time, you know, nothing too heavy. He just reads it while away the hours after the workday and unwind.
But the blizzard ended up having an outsized impact on Bruce's life, correct?
Absolutely.
This was a formative moment for Bruce, even if he doesn't understand it to be one at the moment that he opens it.
You won't believe he waited for the trade.
You read about Steve, the Signal. You read about Hans. You read about the other characters in the blizzard. And all of this starts to form connections to that moment that you met Angie in your mind. But again, as you're looking at this from the outside, it feels like you're analyzing it, like you're studying it. None of the emotional impact of these moments is with you. They just seem like one link in a chain leading to the next. And when you land at the one prior to that, there's a woman standing over you, and she looks concerned. And this woman has a name tag with the word visitor plastered on her chest. And the name below that is Donna, which she's put in quotes afterwards, Dee Dee. But you don't know her by that name. You only know her as Mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she is worriedly stroking your hair and telling you that it's going to be okay, Brucey. Don't worry, Brucey. But you don't have any recollection of why she would be this upset. What is going on here? Do you know?
I don't think Bruce really knows.
This is in kind of a dark part of Bruce's past, isn't it? This is one of those memories that surfaces, but only fleetingly, because this is from a point before Bruce had a lot of coherent memories, right?
Yes.
For you, Bruce, this is almost like a chain floating independent of all the rest. What you can gather here is that this is before Spirit Radio showed up for you, before you were triggered by moments of static, by silence that had become deafening to the point that you could hear the rhythm of the universe inside of it.
Yeah.
This is an independent island floating alone that you can't draw lines to the rest of your story. Jackie.
Yes.
The first part of what you are seeing is an army base in the Pacific Northwest, an area that a small community has conglomerated around. But the community feels patchwork. It feels almost like it's an act of desperation. And the only thing around that you feel that same true connection to is Ace. Ace, who has been a constant and true in your life for the last 4 to 5 years. There aren't many dogs left at this point, because just like people, they were subject to the same parasite as everyone else. Can you tell me what life is like on the base at this point?
At this point, there's a pretty regular routine. Daily life is not real exciting, but it's definitely sometimes a struggle. Everyone has to pitch in. Resources are still pretty scarce. Definitely no wasting. I, with being with the military, are not worried about, like, meals. I mean, they're not extravagant. They're pretty basic, whatever has been scrounged up locally. Meals are more vegetarian than they would be of any kind of protein meat source, since most all the animals that were in any populated areas would have gone with the people.
Well, it was largely mammalian life, right? I imagine that you might still be able to find chicken, perhaps, but the means to raise chickens, maybe less so.
Well, yeah, but like having livestock would be highly sought after commodity, so it would be something, yeah, that would be like guarded. So more for the eggs than butchering the chickens, and
sure,
because, you know, the short supply of that.
So you're in a time where resources are jealously guarded and people are loath to waste anything, up to and including any remaining livestock, in the interest of being able to eke as many resources out of them as possible.
Yes, and with it being the community built around the military base, there's a little bit better protection and security there, so we're not fighting off as much as we did in the first few years of people trying to take things and steal things.
Understandable. You're speaking of the military base currently inside one of the facilities there. It's a doctor's office, because you are in fact a doctor. And similarly to many other afternoons after you've stopped seeing patients for the day, you have a folder with the words neuropathogenic viremia emblazoned across the front, laid open on your desk. Envy, or as it's more commonly known, the jitters, is something that is responsible for the lack of livestock, the lack of dogs, and indeed the lack of people. Which leads us to about a decade prior. You're freshly minted out of medical school, schooling that was largely paid for by your involvement in the Air Force, and you are confronted with a growing epidemic that is rapidly infecting the population. This, of course, is NV, neuropathogenic viremia. What you know about it at this point is that it is particularly insidious. It resembles common ailments for people that are newly infected, such as a cough, the sniffles, a runny nose, sneezing, often disguising itself as something similar to the common cold before it progresses to increasing fatigue and weakness and cognitive impairment, before the final stages where muscle tremors become prevalent and people begin hallucinating and losing control of their limbs, before they end in a series of seizures and prolonged coma. It's shown itself to be extremely resistant to treatment, and it spreads in a way that seemingly defies all efforts at containment. How old are you at this point, Jackie?
I'm 28.
And at the onset of all this, before there was the name Envy, before there was anyone calling it the jitters, you had a dossier on its effects and its spread. You had firsthand experience with this, because some of the very first people that had fallen to neuropathogenic viremia were your folks. What were your parents' names?
My parents' names were Frank and Lois.
Frank McLeod and Lois, his adoring wife, together for 32 years at that point. In a matter of 2 weeks from each other, both fell into prolonged comas before the only thing keeping them alive was the machine breathing for them and the machine circulating their blood. They had effectively gone brain dead from the time that they had contracted it, to the best of your knowledge, from the time that they showed more symptoms than just a cold, to the time that they were dead, was only a matter of 3 weeks. It was traumatic, to say the least. You went into your last year of study feeling like you had everything figured out, and then the world started to crumble around you. And the thread leading from this point to the point of you sitting as one of the lone medical personnel in the entire state is clear and bright as day. Prior to all that, there was an experience in your early teenage years with another important adult in your life, your Aunt Deb. Can you tell me a little bit about Aunt Deb?
She is who I would spend my summers with. She had a little farm, just some basic livestock, chickens, couple really friendly cows, some pigs, and an extensive garden, which also she had a special area that was mostly herbs and stuff, but it was like the things that had medicinal purposes as well. She was a natural healer. She taught me so much during the summers and what got me originally interested in the medical field and trying to help and heal others.
Aunt Deb really was what kicked off this whole chain of events. She was the anchor point in this particular thread of your life. The decisions that had brought you up to the point from young girl developing an interest in medicine to the tragedy at the outset of the fall to the moment that you felt like you had exhausted every last resource you had to understand how to help heal a dying world and began searching for answers through unconventional means.
Yes.
And our last inhabitant in this dream state. Jenny Thomas. Jenny, ever since finding that article in your father's attic, something has plagued you. Something has felt like you don't quite fit in the world around you. Is that accurate?
More or less. It's definitely jarring and has made Jenny question everything.
You feel almost as if your attack on, I would have to assume in this world, that you've spent a majority of your life now feeling like you're on the outside, and after years of being bullied, it has to feel like at this point you have to fight for every connection that you have.
Right. And fight, definitely. She really just picks more carefully, right? Like, she's not going to try to make friends with everyone because clearly not everyone wants to be friends with her. So she's going to be very selective in who she associates with and, like, keeps close to her.
And it's after finding this article that it really sets you off trying to understand what your place in this world is, a world that you already don't feel like you fit fully in.
Right.
That article, of course, an obituary for Jenny Thomas. Surely a misprint, but it doesn't feel that way looking at it. And that leads you eventually to an invitation to a nondescript and mysterious website. Can you tell me what it was like for Jenny the first time that she logged on to the Rift?
It was definitely very interesting. Clearly, there's a wide range of topics, all kind of in the same realm of like weird, strange oddities, unnatural things, supernatural things. So she knew she was in the right place, but just kind of scrolling through some of the posts, you know, you'd have this thing out in left field and then this thing out in right field. And they all kind of danced around that same topic, that same vibe. So she wasn't quite sure what to make of it. And then just kind of started commenting on things as she realized that other people in the Rift were going through their own personal crazy stories. And she wanted to help and be helpful, so she would comment on things. And that's how she started actually getting involved and making this group of friends on the Rift.
So the posts themselves, largely nonsense, right?
Yeah.
But the comments and the discussions and the people that she met along the way, really her first taste of anything resembling a community that she felt like she fit in.
Right. Albeit she couldn't really tell how, but it felt right.
Growing up, though, Jenny didn't have that. She had her one friend that stuck with her through the accident. But otherwise, she had an upward struggle just to be accepted as being worthy to be there. She wasn't outright hostily handled by her peers, but she was treated more as an undesirable element that somehow polluted an otherwise pristine space. Do you think that would be an accurate way to describe high school for you?
Oh, absolutely. And even probably middle school at that, where, yeah, nobody was outrightly mean, but they definitely didn't want to, like, hang out with her, right? Like, if she came to, like, sit down at the lunch table, like, they would conveniently finish their lunch and leave.
She was bearing those scars not only on the outside of her. It wasn't just the burn scars that traced down from her neck and across her arms and down to the tops of her hands. It was deep and emotional at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so.
And that same pain, that same lasting feeling of being unwanted, chased Jenny into her fledgling adulthood. And to the moment where she saw an article that seemed to clearly state, as others had been implicitly stating, that she didn't belong here. And the reason for that happened years prior to that. Can you tell me about the afternoon of the fire before it started?
Yeah, so Jenny was upstairs in her bedroom doing kid stuff. She was single digits, probably about 9. So she was just kind of upstairs playing with her Barbies, doing her thing, and she started to smell smoke, and she could hear her dad yelling, you know, trying to scream, get everyone's attention. But being a 9-year-old kid, she decided to ignore her parents, because what else would you do? You're playing with your Barbies. But as the smell got stronger and stronger, she realized it's probably not popcorn burning. And she opened her bedroom door to see what was going on. And of course, all of that black smoke just billowed in, almost pushing her over. She tries to scream for her parents, but as she breathes in, she starts choking on all of the smoke and just starts hacking and coughing. And she hears her mom scream from the other room. And she instinctively starts trying to reach her mother. And she's feeling around. The smoke is thick and dark. She can't really see. She's just sort of feeling along the walls, trying to remember, you know, was there's end table here, that kind of thing. She finally gets to her mom, and they hug each other. And her mom, you know, Jenny, get on the ground. Jenny, smoke rises, so we go down. We can breathe a little bit better. And they do. And at first, they can. It's not too bad at the beginning. However, that very quickly changes. And as they're crawling around, her mother realizes that even at this low space to the ground, the air is becoming unbreathable. So her mom grabs a blanket, throws it over the two of them to try to weed out some of that smoke, maybe protect them from the flames a little bit. And she tells Jenny to crawl underneath her. Jenny's a small girl. She's, even at the age of 23, she's 5 feet, 100 pounds soaking wet kind of person. So as a 9-year-old, she's very small. She's very easily able to crawl under her mom. So they're kind of, you know, bear crawling around, and they get to a certain point and they're greeted with flames. So they, you know, back up and go a different way. They're greeted with more flames. They end up backtracking. And this whole time, Jenny's mom is telling her to keep going. And Jenny can hear it in her mother's voice that she's actively trying to stay calm. She doesn't realize it as a child. Of course, looking back on it as an adult, she knows that obviously her mom was trying to stay calm to keep Jenny calm. But her mom just continuously was repeating things along the lines of, just keep crawling, baby, we're almost there, we're just gonna get to the window. Just all these types of phrases again and again as they're crawling through the smoke. And the flames are closing in, and Jenny can feel the heat starting to lap at her toes as they're sticking out, or her hand when it crawls out from under the blanket. And her mom realizes that if this blanket is going to do anything for them, she's going to have to give it all to Jenny. So she takes it off, puts it solely around Jenny, and kind of like wraps her almost, not quite, she could still crawl, but kind of cocoons her in it so she's more protected. And the two of them continue crawling with her mom kind of hovering over her, still trying to protect her. They're making their way to the back farthest room, which they presume is their last chance to get to a window. And They're going and they're going, and the smoke's coming in. They can feel the heat and the flames getting hotter and hotter. And suddenly Jenny feels the weight of her mother just fall on her. And Jenny didn't realize at the time, but what had happened is her mother had passed out from smoke inhalation. Unfortunately for Jenny, she was laying right on top of her based on how they were crawling, right? So Jenny is trying to wiggle free. She's trying to get out. She's cocooned in this blanket, and she can feel the flames. Her mom's clothes are starting to light on fire, and she's breathing in the smoke. And as she's struggling and trying to wiggle, and she starts breathing heavier and heavier, and she's inhaling more and more of the smoke, she can feel it in her lungs as her lungs start to burn, and her eyes are burning, and she can feel the fire go from her mom's clothes to her own clothes. She can feel her skin melting, and she can't get out from underneath her mom. The last thing she remembers as she falls unconscious is the sound of sirens coming down the street. And then she passes out.
That whole sequence of events was a turning point in your life. And something happened there that would come to dictate how the next... Well, it would come to dictate how the rest of your life would play out up until this point. And had there been no fire, had there been no losing your mom, had there been no ostracization, had there been no bullying, had there been no issues with trying to find community that accepted you for who you were, you may never have ended up where you are now, unconscious, in the back of an SUV with a man driving who had never driven prior to 10, 15 hours ago. But that's where you find yourself. As you're all drifting through, you start to come to as you're crossing over the border into Tennessee.
This has been What's in the Rift. If you enjoyed our show, please remember to rate and review on your favorite podcast platforms. If you really enjoyed our show, you can support us directly via Patreon or join our Discord. Both links can be found at whatsintherift.com.
What's in the Rift is brought to you by Gas Station Drugs.